Welcome to the Agile Book Club. You are your hosts, Justina and Paul.
This is the Agile Book Club podcast, and we're here to talk about our favorite reads in the Agile world because we're all about continuous learning, continuous education, always bettering ourselves because we're such
brilliant broken people.
I was going to say broken. Broken okay. People. Broken people badly in need of reform.
Okay. I thought that you are going to flatter us a little bit that we are both, you know, oriented for self-improvement. So we are reading and reading more and more. But okay. We are broken people. So
That's why we need to work. That's why we all need to work so hard. And with this episode, we're going to be talking about the book Rethinking Agile by Klaus Leopold. And here's the format. This is the very first podcast. Nobody has heard this before. You might be the first one ever to hear it. You listening right now. You might have been the first person to download it, the first person to hear it. And so this is what you can expect. What we're going to do is, with each podcast, we're going to talk about a different book. And we're going to talk about what we liked about the book, what we didn't like about the book, what we learned from the book, whether or not you should read it, because we're here to save you time. We read this book five times. And money. Yeah, books are expensive. Time is money. Books are money. Books are time. So we're kicking it off with Rethinking Agile, which was a book recently published by our friend Klaus Leopold. And we're not reading it because he's our friend. We're reading it because it's really colorful and has lots of pictures.
Yes.
So this is the format. We're each going to say how we would try to pitch this book to a friend of ours. Not you. We don't know you. What we would say if we wanted to pitch this book to a friend of ours. Justina, what would you say to a friend who said, should I read this book?
Yes, I would recommend this book for everyone who went through Agile transformation and thinks that, oh my God, Agile is not for me. It was not worth it. It's not working. And I think like this person should read this book to have a look on what went wrong in their transformation, because Klaus is giving a lot of ideas what could go wrong. And also, I would recommend this book for everyone who is wondering if they needed an Agile transformation or no, because it has a set of ideas and potential problems that might come up in your organization.
You make it sound like it's a transformation horror story, which I would love
yes.
to read. That's a whole genre of literature that seems to be missing in our field is transformation horror stories.
Yes.
mostly limited to just complaining on blogs. I would love to read that. I don't think this is a transformation horror story. It starts as one.
Yes. First 27 books sound for me like Linkin Park song. In the end, nothing really matters because it shows that everything was perfectly by the book or even better. But in the end, time to market was even worse.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. But that's not what the book is about.
Yes.
Here's my pitch.
Okay.
My pitch is, no, it's not so different than yours, but maybe a little less dark. So if you're starting an Agile transformation or if you're in one and you were lucky enough to bump into somebody who had just completed a very successful Agile transformation and you asked them, so what did you learn? What did you do? And if you were really lucky and they gave you a really helpful, straightforward answer that was inspiring without being prescriptive, it would be this book. That's my elevator pitch.
Beautiful.
Thank you. But I don't have to sell you. You've already read it twice. One of the things I was thinking is, as I was reading it, is this is the way we should have been selling Agile all along.
Because what do you mean?
It goes to something which has been bothering me for quite a few years, mm-hmm. and which I've been talking about at conferences and such, which is this notion that the easiest place to apply Agile is Agile practices, I should say, is at the team level. And so that's also where the money is. There's only one executive team in a corporation, but there might be 30 development teams. And so do you train the senior management team or do you train the development teams? That's where the money is in the corporation.
Mm-hmm.
Corporations always have a budget for training, but that budget is not for executive training. That budget is for line manager and worker training. And so Klaus makes a point in this book as well that it's very common that executives, even if they want to continue to develop and improve themselves, they very rarely have the time because mm-hmm. it's so much more competitive than the line manager, the middle manager, the scrum master, the developer roles. These people all know the importance of making time to learn, but they also are in an environment where they're supported in learning for the most part, and their training budgets and conferences and this sort of thing. But by the time a person becomes the CEO of a major corporation, it's very difficult for them to make time for learning, especially the kind of learning that really challenges your mindset, like agile thinking does. And so as a training company, the low-hanging fruit, the easy money, is let us train all of your teams to be agile, and then you'll have agile teams. Mm-hmm. So what happens is most agile transformations start with the teams, even if people know better. Because if the CEO says this team has to show up for training on Wednesday, then the team shows up for training on Wednesday. But if the agile consultant from an outside firm tells the CEO that she needs to assemble her entire executive team for a full-day agile workshop, the chances of that falling through, of members not being able to make it, people being pulled out by this important thing or that important mm-hmm. thing are really high. I have a friend who is a very experienced agile coach and Kanban trainer in the UK. And I once watched him suffer through a year-long engagement in which he could never get two senior managers to sit down in a room on schedule in the entire year, and let alone a full day or a week of training.
I have a funny expression for that, because recently on the Agile Coach Camp that I went, one of our friends, she told me that this is the game, catch me if you can, that this is how she described her tries to cooperate with executives, that it's like impossible for her to catch them since like 7 months already, even though that they pay her to change the organization. And she's telling them, guys, I use your money, but I need you on the board. And since 7 months, I couldn't make it to meet with you. So you can keep paying me, but it's nothing gonna change.
So if this were the first blue book on Agile, I think maybe the Agile world would have evolved somewhat differently. Can you imagine if the Agile certifications, if the first certification that came out of the Scrum Alliance was a 1 week long certification program for senior management, as opposed to the certified Scrum Master, for example. And then training people lower down was an afterthought, because you don't have, obviously, we make money training. I'm a trainer. I teach Kanban and I want to keep doing that. And I like doing that. It is frustrating for me to teach people how to do things that they're going to have a great deal of difficulty doing, or things which they may never be able to do because of mm-hmm. the nature of the environment that they're in. But no, how different would the world be if agile transformations actually always did start at the top, and if agile was seen as a senior leadership function? That's kind of the world that Klaus paints, but I like the way he paints it. So can we get into the book?
Yes.
So the way Klaus lays out this book is, first he paints a picture of what is basically a failed agile transformation. It's a company that needs to improve its time to market. And so what we're talking about here is enterprise agility. We're talking about agility at the company level. When you talk about agile in teams, you're talking about trying to increase your throughput while maintaining or improving your quality. But that doesn't help if at the company level, you're not actually responding to market change any faster just because some of your teams are producing faster. And so that was the motivation behind their agile transformation, is they wanted to get products to the market more quickly, and they wanted to be able to respond to market changes more quickly because they had small, very agile startups that were starting to nip at their market share, and they just couldn't bring something to market fast enough to stay ahead of these people. And so they did the traditional thing. They brought in a whole bunch of agile coaches and they trained all of their teams in agile processes and agile thinking as well. And then team by team, they learned how to be agile. And what they found is that despite the fact that they did this, what they were planning on doing very successfully, the results were very negative. They were actually, their time to market was longer. And so the hero steps into the story, and this is the author, of course.
Of course. Surprise, surprise. Klaus Leopold.
And he comes in. Now, this is what I like about the story, is that he essentially talks about what he did. And what he did is not just what he did on a very, very practical, specific way, which he does do, but also the theory that drives what he was doing in the air. So that this is not a prescriptive approach. He doesn't say, I did this, and then I did this, and did this, and that's how you should do it. And what he says is, what I'm trying to do is apply these principles, and these are how the principles were applied in this particular organization. And those principles essentially are that you need to focus your agile mechanisms on the part of the company that you want to be agile. And so what you want to do is have your products be released in a more agile fashion. Then you should look at the way you think about organizing and managing your products, not your teams. The way he puts it in the book is you should apply WIP limits on the thing that you want to improve. Mm-hmm. And in this case, as in so many other cases, you start off with these big product ideas. And the product ideas, if they're implemented, become a backlog of stories. The backlog of stories get broken down into tasks. And then the teams apply WIP limits to the tasks so that the tasks flow through the system smoothly. And that's great if what you want to do is have tasks flow through the system more smoothly. But if what you want to do is have projects flow through the system more smoothly, the exact same mechanisms work. You have to limit your WIP and apply visualization tools at the project level. And as much pushback as you get when you start talking about WIP limits with teams of rather junior people, mm-hmm. your programmers and your testers and your designers, imagine how the kind of pushback that you would get from your VP of marketing and your CEO and your CTO to applying WIP limits to their dreams, to their visions for their company. But that's what he's saying.
So what would be your first takeaway from the book?
So the first takeaway is that this is lovely. He paints a rather complex picture of progressive and dramatic change through an organization. But essentially what he does is divide the organization into three different levels, which he refers to as flight levels, different levels of visibility into the work. At the lowest flight level, you're looking at how a team works. At a higher flight level, you're looking at how teams relate to each other. And at the highest flight level, you're looking at how the organization as a whole delivers value to its customers. And the exact same improvement strategies work in each of those levels. And essentially what he did is for each one, he just first visualize what's happening, then limit the work in progress, and then implement feedback loops. And the feedback loops are basically just meetings or opportunities for people to talk about the right thing at the right time. And those things don't look exactly the same at every level, but it makes his whole approach to transforming the way a large corporation works very simple. Visualize what's happening, limit mm-hmm. the work in progress, and then implement feedback loops.
But how sounds easy.
It does sound easy, which is why I appreciate the fact it would be really easy to write a theoretical book yes. based on that idea. Mm-hmm. It would look something like how I would do Scrum with an executive team if I did Scrum with an executive team. And it would probably look a lot like just mm-hmm. following the Scrum rules. What I appreciate about this is he's also telling a story, which is a true story. And at no point does he say you have to visualize this way. This is how we visualized. You don't have to limit your WIP this way. This is how we limited the WIP and why. And you don't have to have exactly these meetings with these people to implement feedback loops, but this is how it worked here. So you get both the theory, but you also get a good example of how it works in practice. And I appreciated that very much. So what works for the team works at other levels as well, was my first mm-hmm. big takeaway. How about yours?
I really like the way Klaus described the whole situation, because there was no negativity. He was really appreciating what they have done. He was really appreciating the attitude that they have and all the boards, visualization, measuring. And by walking through everything, he was discovering what could be added to make it successful. I really enjoyed the example with executive managers who actually had too many good ideas and too many initiatives that they were trying to implement over the year. And the problem there was that they were making all decisions isolated. They didn't talk with each other because, as like most of the big organizations, they had planning in December, let's say 2018, that they planned the whole year till next December. And they didn't talk during the year. They didn't have any strategic portfolio management. And because of that, all of those great initiatives were like constantly pushed into the system. And as I said at the beginning, this book might sound like a horror story for the first 27 pages, but then it shows how sometimes good attitude and postures in organization can work out, that even though that you try to do good things, it might not work for you.
Mm-hmm. I've seen this a lot before. I've had the opportunity to participate in annual planning, budgeting and project planning at a few different corporations. Mm-hmm. And the story is always the same. At the highest levels, when they're doing the planning for the year, it's always annual. I've never been in an organization that actually plans for a quarter. They plan the quarter, but they've also have the other quarters planned. So the annual planning is a fixture in every corporation that I've been in. And the way it works is people come together into a room. It usually takes at least a day, sometimes as much as a week. And they start out with 50 initiatives mm-hmm. that they want to implement. And they know they can't have them all. They know they can't implement these 50 initiatives. All of them have bubbled up to the top because they're highly valuable. Oftentimes, there's a lot of politics involved. There's people whose egos are attached, whose position is it. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But everyone in the room understands that the company is not going to be able to do all 50 because this company has never released more than 20 products in a year. Last year, they released 20. The year before that, they released 18. The year before that, they released 15. The year before that, they released 17. It's like 15 to 20 products is what they do every year. And so they end up doing the same thing that they do every year. They start having sometimes rational conversations about which of these should be eliminated, often political conversations mm-hmm. about which of these should be eliminated. And so they take this big stack of 50 things that they badly want, and they manage to whittle it down to 25. And they're very proud of themselves because they know in their gut that even though their development department has never managed to develop more than 20 new products, they always knew and they believe in their people that they could do it. This time, the Agile transformation is going to work. This time, they're going to be more focused. This time, they're going to do things right. And wouldn't it be a terrible shame if they planned for less than they could handle and they didn't know what to do with their last quarter? So they think, okay, we're really proud of ourselves. We've managed to knock 25 things off of this list. Now we've got a list which is stretch goals, or mm-hmm. this is our optimistic profile, or what have you. But once it's set in paper and once it's communicated out as expectation. And
But what I find a little bit bothering is like they created this big document. They store it sometimes in Excel, let's say, as goals for the year. And then after a few even weeks, no one looks there because it's like not updated, or there are new initiatives that are ongoing and no one knows who put those initiatives there, if they don't have, you know, capacity and etc. So these strategic plans get outdated, I would say, pretty fast. So I can't understand why they don't do it more often. Is it because of the time constraints that it's, you know, created by those executives and they don't have so much time to meet like quarterly, or it was the way that they have always done it, so why they would do it more often?
I think it's tied very strongly, kind of like Klaus insinuates in this book, to the idea of annual budgeting.
Okay.
So the budget's attached to the projects, and almost all large corporations budget annually because it's a big project that involves everyone in the corporation. And mm-hmm. so they batch it. It's a big chunk of work, so they batch it once a year. But just because you've got an annual budget doesn't mean that you have to plan exactly how you're going to spend mm-hmm. every cent 9 months out. I've seen the same thing. But that nobody changes it. But usually it's not forgotten. Usually what I've seen happen is they make these plans and then inevitably they start to slip almost mm-hmm. immediately. Sometimes that slip isn't noticed at the top because of watermelon reporting. It starts to slip, but the scrum master thinks that they can catch up. Mm-hmm. And so they cherry coat it. And so their line manager cherry coats it. And it might be, you know, months into the year before you realize that you're already weeks or a month behind the plan. But what's amazing to me is rather than rethinking the plan at that point, because if you're 2 weeks behind 1 month in, mm-hmm. that's a very good indication yeah. that the promises that you've made for the next 11 and a half months are going to be extremely challenging. Mm-hmm. That's corporate speak. That's what they say. Extremely challenging, but we can do it. No, that mistakes have been made. We know mm-hmm. who made them, and they were made a few weeks ago, and we should start doing corrective action now. Instead, all of the discussion is about how can we get this thing back on track? Mm-hmm. And whether that's hiring new people, changing the way they work, often just putting more pressure on people, whatever it is, what's astonishing to me is how these conversations about how to get things back on track can continue throughout the entire year.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So I can kind of understand if you mm-hmm. get off to a slow start, how you can learn from the first few weeks, learn from the first couple of months, and try to improve based on that. But when you're way behind your annual plan in November mm-hmm. and you're still talking about how you're going to cram everything into December and get more done in December than you got in your first two quarters, that's just...
Oh, but one of the things that I really like about Klaus' book and this chapter about strategic portfolio management was actually that he incorporated those strategic goals into the board. Into the visualization and transparency for all teams, that they knew what are the strategic goals and how projects and tasks that they are having correspond with them. And it was really interesting for me because last week we had a training and one of our colleagues, she said that during these planning sessions, they are all on Skype and she has to send a message to her team members to say, okay, now you have to turn on and say, yes, I agree. Or, you know, what is your status in that case? That their team members are not active in the whole conversation, the whole long Skype calls, they just get incorporated once they have to raise their voices. So I really like this example of the board that Klaus designed that really incorporated those strategic goals so all team members could understand why they do what they do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Another takeaway
yeah.
that you got.
Oh, that's really tricky because you covered a lot of them before we started talking about our takeaways. But my first one was to design your own organizational model. In the first part of the book, he was giving example of Spotify and how many organizations try to copy-paste that model, mostly because they thought, okay, once we have Spotify model, we will be agile and we will succeed with all of our goals. And actually what Klaus emphasized is like they were not agile because they had this model. They were agile because they have the structure that helps them and enable them to deliver customer value, to deliver what they promise, to deliver what people who are paying them expect. So he really pointed out that you have to try to find the optimal model for your own organization. Okay, you can try with copy-paste of a model A and then observe how it works for you and change it by the time. There is not like, you know, something that you can just buy and incorporate in your team because it's all teams are different.
Well, even Spotify doesn't use the Spotify model.
Yeah.
The Spotify model just represents how they were organized at one particular time many, many years back in their past.
Exactly.
they're not so tied to it that they stuck with it. They're, mm-hmm. because they are agile.
Yes.
They keep learning new and better ways. As the market changes, as the business changes, as they find better ways to work, they change it.
I also think that this importance of creating your own structure within your organization goes along with those flight levels, this model that Klaus described, that you have to understand what is the big picture in your organization, then zoom it a little bit more to see what are the collaboration between teams and then see what's happening inside your teams. And once you have this view, you can try to come up with your own structure. What is your takeaway? One more takeaway from Paul.
I've got plenty more to talk about this book. It's a short little book, but it's got a lot of great ideas in it. You know, one of the ones that I really liked was just the idea that transformation takes a lot of time. It's not a project that you can just plan out and roll out in a waterfall manner, that we're going to do a transformation, and so these people need to be trained. The trainings are scheduled for these dates. They're going to implement a new way of working on these dates, and by this day, we'll be agile. What we see here, rather, is that they've gone through that process and they've implemented agile practices the way they wanted to, even on schedule. But the whole actual process of becoming an agile organization is ongoing. And the work that Klaus does with this company happens over a period of quite a bit of time. So this idea that it's a thing you do rather than a change in mindset or a change in the way in which you think about how the company is run is, I think, it's unhealthy to think that you can do agile fundamentally, like he says, it's ridiculous to implement an agile transformation in a non-agile way. And I think that's important.
I have one good quotation from the book that goes along with what you said. If a desired state is agility,
the way to get there is agile?
Yes.
If the desired state is agility, the way to get there is agile.
Yes, exactly.
Indeed. That is amusing. But I think that's an important message, too, because these sorts of transformation initiatives are painful and disappointing. Any transformation is disappointing. Not that the outcome is disappointing, but there are points of disappointment along the way. Expectations always deviate from reality. Mm-hmm. And if the goal is continuous improvement, then that is an ongoing goal. It's not a specific outcome. Mm-hmm. And I don't say that to scare anybody off of agile transformation, but there's a lot more to be gained from doing a gradual, careful review of how you work on a regular basis at multiple levels over a long period of time, then throwing a huge amount of money into hiring dozens of consultants mm-hmm. and just doing a big upfront, big bang training endeavor.
Have you ever seen organization that went to agile transformation and once they realized that results are not good for them, they stopped and came back to what they were doing before?
Oh, absolutely. I think that's more common than success.
Okay.
Many, many such companies, none of which I will name in public.
Okay. So it's like we forget that we tried, we come back to what we are doing before. Yeah?
Yes.
Okay.
In fact, many of the companies that you know as not being particularly agile have had agile transformations in the past, okay. Sometimes more than one. Even here in this city from which we are podcasting.
What was the funniest name of agile transformation that you heard? Because I heard like agile knockout or...
Oh, goodness. Off the top of my head. I can't do that one. Agile knockout?
Yes.
Okay. The violence of that language.
Yes. You're agile or we'll knock you out. Yeah. Sorry.
Next, moving right along. He talked a bit about estimation. I think this was one of my takeaways. Mm-hmm. I'm a big proponent of making estimation as low cost an endeavor as possible. And I do a lot of training in how to use statistical forecasting methods. But I'm not one of these hardcore people in the no estimates camp. I think rather a pragmatic approach is to do no more estimating than necessary. And that can be really tricky because how much estimating is necessary?
That was my question to you right now.
Well, this is the problem, and this is what happens, is somebody says, you know, I just want a thumbsuck. I just want a high-level estimate. But they don't say it to the person doing the work. So if the CTO says, I just want a high-level estimate, they tell that to a department manager who tells it to a line manager who tells it to a scrum team who tells it to their developers. And by the time it gets down to the developers, each person, since they're reporting to a person more senior to them, actually imbues more weight and significance to the order. And so if If the CTO were to just grab a developer over lunch and say, how big do you think this is? The developer might be able to read their body language and say, okay, I can see that this person is just asking for a rough guess. But when it comes from your boss's boss, you put a lot more weight on it. And so I think a lot more effort gets put into estimations than the person who requested the estimate really expected would happen. But another thing that happens is the way the estimations turn into plans. And then when you ask for a rough estimate and then start getting very frustrated when the project goes 10% over budget or 20% over budget, what you communicate is that you didn't mean you wanted a rough estimate in the first place. Mm-hmm. You wanted a very accurate estimate. And so those two phenomena, either working together or independently, I think lead to a lot of wasted time and effort. But the point that Klaus makes is if your goal is to try to be agile, then the purpose of estimating shouldn't be to get a highly accurate estimate so that you can do an ROI analysis and roll that up into your annual planning. You should be getting an estimate as late as humanly possible for the purpose of making a decision as quickly as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And if the estimates are happening low down in the organization and the information from the estimate is being used high up in the organization, there's probably a huge time lag. And that is very unagile. The best way to do an estimate in this particular case, if you're just trying to make a decision between two projects, which one to start next, and again, in an agile way, you shouldn't be talking about which project to start next when you're sitting in January planning your third quarter. The time to be talking about which of these two projects to start next should be when you have a team that mm-hmm. you see is about to be releasing in a few weeks and they're about ready to start preparing to take on a new piece of work. Then you say, okay, well, we've got these two things that this team is qualified for that both seem very important to us. We need to make a quick estimate. So grab the right people into the room, make your quick estimate, take a decision, and then start the work.
Yes.
Estimating work that you're not going to start for another 6 months strikes me as hugely wasteful and very non-agile.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and especially like estimating the work that you might not even start next year or it's never going to happen
mm-hmm.
because markets change or your competitor came up with a different idea and you have to make it better right now. Yes.
Well, most ideas are never implemented.
Yes.
Most ideas are never implemented and most bugs are never fixed. Mm-hmm. So that gets me into another rant, which is about bug cataloging and management. I won't go into that because mm-hmm. it's not about the book. But indeed, estimating, prioritizing, talking about managing, reprioritizing, tracking, anything that you're highly unlikely to ever action is mm-hmm. all just a waste of human time and effort.
Mm-hmm. One more takeaway for me was in case of team performance, that it doesn't matter if your team is the most agile in the organization and deliver as fast as it is possible, because the other team might start working on that in the next 20 days. And it doesn't matter that you deliver that within 5 days, because it's going to stay there for the next 15 days. And all of this local optimization might bring system sub-optimization. So you have to look at the whole team collaboration in order to find the perfect flow for your organization.
Mm-hmm. And this is one of the parts that I found to be really inspiring in this book.
Yes.
Because I've spent time in organizations in which teams work independently on independent projects. But astonishingly, I was in an organization once in which there were several teams. They all were constituted basically the same. They had the same back-end programmers, front-end programmers, designers, UX researchers, mm-hmm. the same people in the same roles, sitting in the same office layout in rows side by side, and the teams never spoke to each other. Never. I mean, mm-hmm. you could be sitting back-to-back with a person doing a similar role to you on a similar project in the same company, and simply never have a relationship at all, even if you shared a lot in common, like shared dependencies, for mm-hmm. example. Now, in this case, he's talking about a couple of things. One is they, in this company, they had decided that a team would focus on only one product,
yes.
which is very logical. However, some products are bigger than one team. Mm-hmm. And so even if it was one project per team, it wasn't one team per project. And so you might get these scenarios in which you've got multiple people working, like you were describing, multiple teams working on components of a product, but they can't be implemented in the order in which they're being produced, and there's no coordination at that level.
I really like your example from your previous job that you had, when you optimized the time of delivery of your team, but it really didn't matter because it couldn't be implemented because you were waiting for shared service.
Mm-hmm. Yes. That's something he didn't deal with much in this book, but I'd like to talk about it, a little bit about it. But like I said earlier, he basically says each place that you're trying to improve, he applies these three steps. You visualize, you limit the WIP, and you create feedback loops. And so, for example, when he had multiple teams that were all working on the same product, he encouraged them to create product boards. Mm-hmm. And if there were just a couple of teams, sometimes the product board would replace the team's Kanban boards, because you'd have a product board and it would just have swim lanes representing each of two or three teams, and then they could all come together. And when you're doing that, when the teams are actually talking to each other, because that's the feedback loop part, even if that if the teams had one product board, they might stop having individual team stand-ups and have three teams doing their stand-up in front of the product board. But in bigger projects where there's five or six or seven teams, they would still have a product board, which might be a simplified view of the individual team boards. And once a week, representatives of the team would have a stand-up in front of it. Mm-hmm. And that's where they would discover things like, we're about to start working on this feature. And then a member of another team would say, we're not going to be able to support that for at least another month because we'd have to build out the back end for that feature. And so a decision might be taken to deprioritize that feature in favor of something that could be released earlier. And it's really simple. When management thinks about coordinating between teams, it might look like a lot of overhead, but I think it's only a lot of overhead if you try to manage it.
Oh, yes.
if you try to manage and control how teams interact with each other, then that can seem really scary. Mm-hmm. But if you trust your teams to take decisions, informed decisions, between themselves, then encouraging that sort of interaction becomes incredibly agile and incredibly beneficial. But I was thinking of an example with a shared service, because I think this is something that a lot of large corporations deal with. It's not something that Klaus talked about in the book, but it got me thinking, could you do something similar with a shared services team? So let's say, for example, you've got multiple teams that are building products, and they all are interacting with backend systems using an API layer, for example. And you've got one API team that's supporting maybe 10 or 20 different product development teams. And I've seen companies try to prioritize work, because there's always, when you've got 20 different teams all screaming for this same shared service, somebody has to do prioritization. But prioritization alone doesn't solve the problem, because the lowest priority request from these 20 teams is the highest priority for the team that got denied, you know?
Yeah.
And that team also has deadlines and expectations. One of the things that I saw in this sort of scenario is a certain predictability at the team level in the need for such a shared service. So if your shared service is deployment, then it's predictable when you're going to need the deployment team to work. Mm-hmm. What I've never seen is all of the teams that rely on that shared service trying to coordinate their deployments in such a way that they don't slam the shared service. Mm-hmm. So we're doing a deployment on Monday. Well, we were going to do a deployment on Monday, but I guess we'll do it on Tuesday. That way, we won't have the deployment team trying to support both of us at once. Mm-hmm. Or we're going to need to develop some features that are going to require new APIs. Well, we also are developing features that require new APIs. Well, let's shift one of our starting points a bit, so we're not both hitting the API team at the same time.
So it's not like the delivery race team A and then delivery race team B, that they just cooperate and
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And that's what happens when you visualize dependencies. Exactly. And then the people who have influence over these dependencies just talk. Mm-hmm. And so that's the visualize, limit, and feedback loop components. Yeah.
Sometimes talking is the cheapest way for improvement.
Talking is the, especially face-to-face talking, is mm-hmm. the cheapest way for improvement, but it requires an enormous amount of trust. Because mm-hmm. one of the scenarios that Klaus throws out here is the scenario in which a team realizes that the work that they are supposed to be doing is less important than the work being done by another team that mm-hmm. needs help.
Oh, yeah.
So in my mind, the ultimate agile organization is one in which a team doesn't need management permission mm-hmm. to change their goals. Mm-hmm. They can see that their time would be better used doing something other than their job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But also through the conversation, you have really interesting discovery over the process that you have. Like Klaus had this example when he started interviewing teams, and he said, like, okay, this is your board, so when are you done? What is before? Okay, so you need, you know, this extra basket with ideas, and those ideas comes from this team, and etc. and etc. It was really interesting experience to see how this small board evolved into a huge board that was having so many steps
mm-hmm.
one conversation, at least in the book.
Absolutely. But I also like the fact that he did this slowly.
Oh, yeah.
I once knew a senior Kanban trainer and coach mm-hmm. who was given the impossible job, the almost impossible job, of designing a corporate-wide workflow for a major multinational corporation that had development and product development teams on every continent. And they were trying to do it in a big bang, so we could switch to the way we're doing it to this new massive system. And the best way to now we're talking more specifically about Kanban when you're talking about end-to-end value stream mapping. But the easiest way to do that is one part at a time, and then connect them where they make sense to connect. But that's another example. If in an organization like that, if you were to pursue it slowly by Kanbanizing different components of the organization and then creating spaces for people to talk where it makes sense for them to talk, some of those Kanban processes could become linked together. Some of them could have buffers put between of them. Some of them could even have WIP limits on those buffers so that you've created a more predictable structure, that a more predictable process that links different parts of the organization. But the ultimate end result of that would not be a single end-to-end beautiful model mm-hmm. because parts of it just wouldn't make sense.
Mm-hmm.
And if it evolves organically, what you'll get is not necessarily something pretty, but something useful. But it takes a lot of time to do. So yeah, what else did I want to say about this book? One of the things that I really liked is the way he deals with portfolio management by using the same basic tools, but applying them to the work that executives do. I think that could be really going in and telling executives you're going to teach them to be agile by teaching them agile theory is nice, but it doesn't really tell them what to do. Mm-hmm. Teaching executives the way that you teach teams doesn't help, because what you don't want your executive team doing Scrum the same way that your product development team does Scrum. And one of the reasons is an observation I really liked from this book, which is that what you expect at the product team level is throughput, and what you want to measure how much they can develop and deliver. But at the highest level, at the portfolio level, what you should be looking at is outcomes. So if you've got the option to do more things, or to do one thing that has a bigger impact, then the one thing that has a bigger impact should be the priority. Mm-hmm. In a team, you just want to have the high priority tasks delivered as fast as you can without sacrificing quality. But the portfolio level, it's the impact that it makes on the company that's important. So you can't use a set of processes and tools that are designed for throughput when you're trying to do something really fuzzy work that is designed to maximize the impact. And the way he did it is by using, starting with this high level, which is visualize, but don't visualize the way they do because you do different work.
Mm-hmm.
Limit your WIP, but don't limit the WIP the way they do because you're doing different sorts of things and you have different sorts of goals. And then implement feedback loops so that you can learn and feed more information into this process at the appropriate times and change or make decisions as you go. And that you could walk away with a prescriptive idea, because the way he does it with this company is very clever and attractive. Mm-hmm. But you can also see how you could apply it in very different environments. And that really appeals to me, because I don't think any CTO wants some consultant from outside the company to teach him or her Scrum.
Yes. And change their mindset and tell them what to do.
What I think an executive team would like is somebody to teach them different and better ways of doing what they're already doing. Nobody likes spending a week in annual budget meetings. Nobody likes being locked in a room for a week. If there was a way that they could make better decisions with more timely information that could be actioned quickly rather than planning that far in advance by simply doing a weekly or biweekly or monthly call, executives would generally really like that. So that appeals to me. And I think that sounds like a much better way to introduce Agile at the highest levels of an organization.
I also think that business agility starts at the top. And when you have those executives on your side, it's easier to make any change because automatically they become your change agents. They have lower resistance because they are the part of the change. So why would they say, you know, constantly no? Why would they undermine what you are trying to do? So I really, really believe, and this book proves that you have to find a way to get them on your side. It will really save your time and energy and their money as well.
Mm-hmm. So, Justina, what was your favorite quotation from this book?
I had two that really made me laugh. The first one was about executives. We are going to implement a waterfall project to become agile.
Yep, indeed. That is just funny. But, it worked. It got them to the point that they were at, which made it a lot easier for Klaus to do what he did, because he had a good starting point to work from. But yes, indeed.
That's it. Was like a very lovely, inside joke that would make a lot of people laugh. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, when you talk about an agile transformation plan that involves, the coaches come in here and these trainings happen here and then these trainings have to happen and these trainings have to happen, you could easily envision that whole thing in a Gantt chart.
Mm-hmm. How about you?
Mine was, since the teams are going to be agile as of the deadline, even more projects can be started.
Yes.
And this is what I was talking about when you're doing annual planning. You plan for the company that you want to have, not for the company that you do have.
Oh, yes. I always think about it as a metaphor of spending annual bonus that you still didn't get in January. You hope to get it in March and you expect that it's going to be so big, so you already booked your holidays in Asia, but then you realize that your bonus is not so big as you hoped. Yeah.
Thank goodness the street food is cheap, huh?
Yes.
So that's what I took away from this book. I highly recommend it. It's a fun read. It's a pretty book. A lot of time and effort went into visualizing the ideas in the book. This is a pretty book and colorful with lots of fun pictures.
And a lot of useful definitions that are mentioned on the side of the book. So I found it extremely useful to recall of what some definitions really means. Like, it was a really, really nice touch.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So it's easy to read. It's a fun read. And it's a lovely read. And it's well written. And it's useful. And it covers, it addresses, I think, a very important aspect of the Agile community, which does not have enough literature to support it right now. And that is our review of Klaus Leopold's Rethinking Agile. So what should we read next?
I just wanted to ask you that question because Paul read obviously more books than I've done and he's very good at recommending.
She means I'm old.
Too, but definitely whenever I found myself into a new topic, I always ask Paul like, oh, Paul, what should I read in this topic? So I would address this question to you this time again.
At some point, I want to get into some of the more detailed fringe books in our world, because there's so many interesting things out there. In these early episodes, I'd like to deal with some of the newer books that have come out, but that address more fundamental topics that are of concern to everyone in the Agile community. And so I'm going to suggest that for the next book, we read Dominika de Grandis's Making Work Visible. Mm-hmm. What do you think?
Yes, I've heard a lot of good about this book, that it simply shows how you lose your money when you lose your time, mm-hmm. and how people don't see that time stealing is actually very costly. So yes, I would love to read that book.
Okay, so stay tuned for the next episode of the Agile Book Club, where we'll be talking about making work visible. Thank you for listening.
Yeah, thank you.